is Iconic with your hosts JM, Mark, and Nick.
Welcome to Iconic, where we talk about all things 13th Age. I'm your host JM, and with me as always is Nick.
Hey!
Today we have a Petri-sponsored bonus episode for you.
We have another review for you today. Thanks to Cam and the folks at Petri's Family Games, they have provided us with copies of Princes of the Apocalypse for Dungeons & Dragons 5th Edition, the new campaign module for D&D, and we're going to just walk through it, you know, give you an overview, tell you what we liked, what we didn't like, and wrap it up with some thoughts on, is it worth getting if you are not a D&D player, but are, as we assume you are, a 13th Age fan. So we'll just get right into it. Princes of the Apocalypse is a sequel, homage, parallel development of one of the iconic Dungeons & Dragons adventures. The Temple of Elemental Evil came out way back in the day, and you can actually get that PDF on dndclassics.com, and we'll have a link to that in the show notes. It was Gary Gygax's kind of mega dungeon that started off. You started in the village of Homlet, you went around to this abandoned moat house and discovered there were these cultists who were worshiping something called the Elemental Evil. And it was your job to stop this plague from spreading through the area and through Greyhawk. And then in 3rd edition, Monty Cook brought the temple back. There was the Return to Temple of Elemental Evil. There was also a video game that came out. And in that, the cult of Elemental Evil had risen up again. This time, and the authors kind of chat a little bit about this. It is not just a reprint or a sequel. The elemental forces behind this cult have turned their eye to the Forgotten Realms. And seeing as the Forgotten Realms is the big D&D moneymaker, it really doesn't come as any surprise to me that this is where they are setting this new adventure. The other thing that did come as a surprise to me is if you look on the back of the book, while this is a Dungeons & Dragons product, and this is printed in distributed by Wizards of the Coast, the writers of Princes of the Apocalypse is Sasquatch Studios, which we had those gentlemen on the show. They are the writers and developers of Primeval Thule, which has a 13th Age book out, which is actually in stores now, I believe.
Cool.
So, well, let's get into kind of the overview of the adventure. The main adventure starts at level 3, but the appendixes give you a number of adventures and side quests to kind of introduce your characters to the storyline and go on from there. Final dungeon is designed to end around 13 plus, level 13 or higher. You get new monsters, new spells, new races and factions. And then Nick, why don't you talk about the player's guide? Because they also released a free player's guide, but you have a couple of options with that, right?
Yeah. You can either download the PDF directly from wizards.com, and we'll provide the links to the show notes. If you want a printed version and you go to DriveThruRPG, you can do print on demand and get it that way as well. The player's guide basically is what it says it is. It's designed to give the players everything that they need to play in this campaign. So they cover all of the spells that are in the book. They cover all of the races that are in the book. They actually include 3 additional races that are not in the Princes of the Apocalypse book. And they're all elementally flavored.
Yeah, so you have the Goliaths, the Genasi in all forms of the Genasi,
the Dark Gnomes, and the, I think it's pronounced Arakakra.
Okay. It's one of those ones that unless I'm looking right at it, I can't pronounce it. But in case anybody from Wizards is listening, and we know that at least one person from Wizards listens to the show, I love that you made this book available as print on demand. And I wish you would do more of that with some of the older books from D&D Classics, like Temple of Elemental Evil, GDQ, maybe all of Birthright, just if I'm going to toss some things out there. Birthright and Planescape should all be available as print on demand because, well, they just should. Okay. So
I will say, in regards to the player's guide, if you're thinking about picking up this book and thinking about, well, maybe I should run this campaign or not, go download the PDF of the player's guide and just kind of read through it and get a feel for what's going to be included in this. Because, yeah. I mean, that requires no investment on your part other than time of actually downloading and reading it. But you're going to get an idea of, okay, these are the types of spells that we're going to be messing with. These are the types of races and flavors that we're going to be dealing with and encountering in all of this.
That's a really good point. And the other thing that Wizards is doing, they did a lot of this in 4th edition, and I think Paizo has really shown that this is a great market strategy. In addition to the Princes of the Apocalypse book and the Free Player's Guide. There's a Princes of the Apocalypse specific GM screen. Gale Force 9 is putting out, or has put out, all of the spells as elemental cards, so you can just get a deck of cards that has all of the spells on them. WizKids has the Princes of the Apocalypse miniatures that you can collect, and Wizards just put out a Temple of Elemental Evil board game along the same lines as Wrath of Ashardalon or Castle Ravenloft, and that comes with a bunch of minis as well. So there's a lot of cross-product placement. Well, and Neverwinter, the MMO, just recently had the Princes of the Apocalypse kind of expansion going through dealing with elemental cultists in Neverwinter. So kudos again to Wizards for just kind of tying all of that together. Well, let's get into the storyline. The overarching story is that this cult of elemental evil has come to Faerûn. Four prophets, one of each of the elements, air, earth, water, and fire, were led to this underground ruin that used to be a dwarven city, and before that, I believe, a drow enclave, and discovered these items of elemental evil that allowed them to establish themselves as these cult leaders for the four cults. And they are working in this Vale of Redlark. Lark?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Was not quite sure.
That's how I pronounce it. Okay, Lark. Lark.
And much like the other Temple of Elemental Evil adventures, your characters will get involved in a very kind of oblique way and start digging and eventually uncover these four temples of elemental evil and move through them and cleanse them, and then dig a little deeper and go into these elemental nodes and have a chance to end this threat, at least for their lifetime. What I really liked about this is that they really made an attempt to distinguish between the four cults, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But I have run a little bit of the original Temple of Elemental Evil, and I ran 80% of Return to Temple of Elemental Evil, and while you had some flavors and spells and coloring, there was no real... It really felt like the Cult of Elemental Evil was a unified whole with maybe some different factions. In Princes of the Apocalypse, it really feels like they're just four separate cults, each with their own flavor and personality, that happen to be working in tandem with each other, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and it goes to the points of even illustrating, these are the cults that tend to work a little bit better together. These are the cults that don't like each other at all. And as you are trying to, you know, invest yourself in with the cults and try to figure out what's going on, potentially saying, hey, I'm against this other cult over here, might buy you or might gain you access into this other one.
Yeah. So yeah, that's basically the overview of the storyline. You're going to start off with some quests in this town. What's the town's name?
Deseret Valley?
Right. Deseret Valley is the valley. Redlark is the town.
Right.
So yeah, you'll be in Redlark and working in the Deseret Valley. And as you start uncovering these quests, that these smaller adventures, you'll start seeing pieces of the cult's influence. And the guys at Sasquatch Studios did a great job of providing GMs with, okay, well, at this point, the cults start picking up on the adventurers are messing with them. And at this point, they start taking retributive action against the people of the valley. So it doesn't feel like a static adventure. Much like Temple of Elemental Evil, as you go through it, the cultists start to respond to what the PCs are doing. So, what are some other parts of the adventure that you would like to highlight, Nick?
Kind of building off of what you were just saying, the actions that the players have do have an impact on the sort of story or the direction of the story that the GM needs to run it. And they do a really good job, like you said, of pointing that out so that if you get to one of the cult leaders or one of the prophets and all three of the other ones are still alive or still in power, then you need to run it this way. If there's only, you know, this one prophet and one other one left, then you need to run it this way. So having some plot consequences to what's going on there is, I really like that. And then also, it's not just, I think it would be tempting as a player to just, once you get an idea that we just got to go to each one of these four cults and destroy them, and then go to the next four dungeons and destroy them, you know, that sort of thing. I can see how it would be tempting to just keep your head down and forget about everything else. But as you're going through this, like you said, the prophets and the cults are starting to be aware of what the players are doing. They start to retaliate in different areas of Deseret Valley. So you may... There are plot hooks in the midst of you going through this dungeon crawl to get out of the dungeon and go back to Red Lark and deal with the stuff that's going on there.
Well, yeah, and that brings up a really good point. Going all the way back to the original temple and even carrying through into some of the more modern throwbacks to that type of adventure, I'm thinking of Dwemermount. You can't just run this as, okay, we're entering the dungeon and we're just going to stay there till it's cleared out. You need that kind of ebb and flow of, okay, the PCs now need a reason to go back to town and recuperate and rest and resupply. Okay, let's go back in and see what we can do now. Without that, you kind of lose the fact that this story is not happening in this isolated microcosm, but is part of the larger whole of the world. All right, well, let's get into what we liked about Princes of the Apocalypse. I really liked Deseret Valley and Red Lark. There is... so much information packed into that first section of the book on the valley and the inhabitants and the town. It is not super detailed. This is how much the innkeeper weighs, and this is what he has done for the last 35 years. But there are so many adventure hooks and story ideas that even without the rest of the adventure, you would have plenty to do for months in-game. Just chasing down these really interesting hooks and seeing how the different pieces of the valley tie together.
Yeah, and I as I was reading through it, I kept being inspired to use what is going on in other games.
Yeah.
Even if you were to buy this book with the intention of, I may never run this, but I want to use it in a different system like 13th Age, because the hooks are so well designed, I think it'd be really easy to grab those and pull them somewhere else. And that was one of the things that I really liked about it.
Cool. The art, like everything for 5th edition, is gorgeous.
Absolutely.
So the four different cults each have their own feel. The Air Cult, they're all Sky Knights, essentially. When you get into the Black Earth cultists, they ride boulettes and other types of burrowing land sharks and are led by a Medusa, which I thought was a neat thing. The Flame Cultists are all berserkers, and they have almost a steampunky kind of feel to them. And then finally, you have the Water Cult, and they are the best example I could use is Pirates of the Caribbean, like Davy Jones and his crew, where their armor might be barnacles that have grown on them, and they might have
They ride sharks.
They ride sharks. I mean, it's really evocative.
Yeah. And one of the things that I want to point out, too, is that all four of the cults have kind of taken root in this one massive underground labyrinth. And as the elemental prophets have started exuding the power of the element that they're tied to, it has started to twist that section of the dungeon to kind of meet that. So for the fire elemental dungeon, you're going to start seeing a lot more lava and flame stuff versus the... water sections have all been flooded, that sort of thing. So there's going to be a lot of contextual flavor in the midst of all of this as well.
The adventure is also very flexible. The way you move through the valley and even through the Temple of Elemental Evil depends greatly on your characters. Did your players latch onto one particular clue? It's very freeform. There is no one correct way to go through the adventure. You may even, when you get into the temple proper, start working in one area of the temple and find a passage to a different, completely different element. And your characters may just say, okay, we're done dealing with water right now. We want to go deal with earth.
I will say that they do point out that each section has been designed with a particular level in mind. Mm-hmm. So that if you are taking... let's say a level 4 player into a level 6 area, you may want to adjust it or just let them realize you're going in way over your head. You need to pull back and maybe reevaluate which one you want to start out with.
Yeah, or just let them die. So the other thing is, much like Rise of Tiamat, there are not a lot of stats in the book. I mean, there are some, especially in the monster section. But if the monster appears in the monster manual, you will just have a reference to that.
Everything that is introduced new is statted out, but everything that is, you know, used elsewhere is going to be found elsewhere.
Referenced, yeah. The book also ends with a number of suggestions for converting Princes of the Apocalypse to other D&D settings like Dark Sun, Dragonlance, Eberron, and even bringing it back to the original world of Greyhawk where the other two temples took place. The only one that was really missing was Planescape, but that might just be ridiculously hard to do. But I really enjoyed seeing the fact that Wizards is not just ignoring their other worlds and focusing on Forgotten Realms. They're giving you little tastes that, yeah, these other worlds are still here and we're paying attention to them.
So one, I know we've talked about this already, but one of the things that I really liked about this is the fact that they do make the player's guide for free. As a player, when I'm looking at playing a game, one of the first questions I ask is, am I going to have to buy a book in order to be able to play my part of it? I don't need to. And at the same time, I don't want to buy the entire book because I don't want to run the entire thing. I may not. I don't want all of those spoilers, but I want enough given to me that I can make the choices to invest in the game. So, being able to get the resources that I need without having to pay anything is a huge boon. As I'm looking at this and saying, would I want to run this? Well, the fact that all my players are going to be able to get a very gorgeous PDF or print-on-demand copy of the player's guide without having to pay anything, that's huge. That's going to be, in my opinion, that's a big selling point on this.
Yeah. There has been a trend in the D20 market, and I would say, 5th edition D&D, and then really Paizo does that. Having a free player's guide just to give the players a taste and an overview and maybe a little bit of guidance on how to make their character is huge. So, dislikes. The one thing that I really disliked about Prince of the Apocalypse was the fact that Rise of Tiamat had all of the monsters that you needed available in a free PDF to download. It was kind of like the GM's guide to it. Not the case anymore. And I understand kind of why they did it, because you're going to want, they want you to go out and buy the monster manual. But to run this as a, you can't run this standalone anymore. You need to go out and get the monster manual for it. Not a huge dislike, but still something that stood out in comparison to Rise of Tiamat. What about you, Nick?
It's kind of two sides of a coin. I really liked the flexibility and, the plot consequences. It felt, as I was reading through it, in just the time of reading through it, I felt it was a little bit complex to follow through what's all taking place here. If players choose A, what does B, C, D, E, all of that mean? I'm a nerd. I would have loved to see a flow chart as you can kind of follow everything through. If this happens, then this happens. But I can also see that as you're playing this, it's going to be a slower process and it may not be that difficult to keep track of. So the complexity of it, while is a huge asset in my mind, it also is something that I would have liked to see maybe a little bit more support for.
Okay. Well, then let's bring it back around to 13th Age. The fact that it's statless, for the most part, makes it real easy to convert to 13th Age. Just grab your 13th Age bestiary and go. You know, you're going to have to do some level adjustments just because it's going to more depend on your game than on the standard D&D progression that comes with the book. But converting monsters from 5th to 13th Age is going to be pretty easy. Go listen to our monster design episode. There's also a series of really good articles on converting 3rd edition monsters to 13th Age and converting 4th edition monsters to 13th Age. And between those three resources, you should be able to take your elemental cultists and work up stats for them. The other thing that I liked for using this for 13th Age, and I actually think I would run this as a 13th Age game as opposed to a D&D 5th edition game. Icons are going to be super easy to do. You have the factions that the characters start off with ties to. Each one of those factions could be an icon. And then you have the four elemental cultists. So you won't have 13. So that's 9 right off the bat. You know, throw in maybe the leader of Red Lark or the dwarves that are involved in the adventure, and you could very easily get to 10 or 11. You really don't need that many for this focused of an adventure.
Right.
So what about you, Nick? What do you think of using this as a 13th age, the basis for a 13th age game?
I think it's a very good basis. I think the overall feel of it, the elemental ties, would require a little bit of monkeying and adjustment. You aren't going to be able to just immediately drop this elemental aspected force into your Dragon Empire or something like that. But I think that it'd be pretty easy to adapt it and reskin it. Yeah.
Cool.
I will say that I think it's a great adventure, and I would be very interested in not only playing in it, but I'd be very interested in running it as well. That perception is not system dependent. It's a great story, and I think it will work very well in regardless of what system that you want to use.
One of the advantages over Rise of Tiamat is that it's only one book, and this book is only $50 as compared to the two $30 books for Rise of Tiamat. And honestly, I think Princess of the Apocalypse was a better story overall than the Rise of Tiamat. I enjoyed the Rise of Tiamat as a story. I really want to run Princess of the Apocalypse.
Well, sign me up.
Okay.
just one thing. I know we mentioned in passing that we really liked the art in the book. The maps I thought were exquisite.
Yeah.
Each section of the map was marked out with, okay, this is, you know, this area of the map correlates with this section of text, and made it very easy to follow the path as the players are going through. If they decide to go in this area, this is what's going to be associated with it. And I'm a huge fan of maps in general, and I was poring over these maps. It almost took me longer to just to look at the map than it did to actually read through what was going on in there. So kudos for that.
Awesome. Well, thank you to Petri's Family Games for the review copies of these books. You can order this book online. You can get it at your friendly local game store, or you can get it online at Petri's Family Games web store.
Well, thanks to Cam and everybody at the Petri's Family Games crew. You can check them out on petrisgames.com.
And if you ever find yourselves in the Colorado Springs area, be sure to look up Petri's Family Games.
Well, you've been listening to the Iconic Podcast.
If you have any questions or comments, you can contact us at whitedragon@iconicpodcast.com or call and leave a voicemail at 720-924-1706.
And check out iconicpodcast.com for news, updates, and new episodes.
Thanks for listening.